All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Let me shut these 900 windows. All right. Oh, we are recording on that.
We've been recording.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, ready? And my computer's on mute.
Awesome.
All right, here we go.
Living in a scientific age, we need citizens who know enough about science to make intelligent decisions about what they do. We use science to prolong life, to increase security and happiness. But it can also be used for destruction. Are we going to use it constructively? It'll be up to you. And you too.
What does you too have to do anything with it? Anyway.
It's up to you, Bono.
And you too. Do you know why cows have hooves and not feet?
Why?
Because they lactose.
See, now, and here's a little bit more behind these. Some of you watching on the Facebook feed will have seen us kind of a couple minutes beforehand here, getting stuff ready, and we didn't broadcast this, but I did record a little bit of us beforehand when we were talking about, well, are these dad jokes ever going to be funny, and am I going to run out of things to play after them? And so here, I'm just gonna play a little bit of our conversation that we had a little earlier here.
Don't you say that. It was funny. It was really funny.
Funny?
It was funny. It was funny, Mac. And it will be funny again, I swear to you. I'm telling you, we're close. It's going to be funny.
Someday.
Someday that will be funny.
Yeah. Maybe.
But until then, sluggish start to another podcast.
Awesome. How's it going, Todd?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm really well. What's this podcast that we're doing today?
Welcome to. I forgot. I'm all out of sorts. I was telling you before, and I felt tired. I was giggling at things, and I feel this morning at church we had the yearly thing where we march all of our Sunday school kids into the big church that their moms and dads are to sing a few Christmas songs. The kids that I take care of are like three, so it was taking right. The preschoolers down there. So I did that this morning, and it went great, and it always does. But I'm just out of sorts, and so I forgot my show notebook, and so I don't even know what show number this is. It's 60-something. I don't know if it's 65 or 66, but... I'm just all over them. So we'll see what kind of a show we get out of me today. And I've pulled two stories, three stories, but two of them have been cracking me up, but have just some of the most terrible and uncomfortable wording to them. So we'll all walk carefully through these next few moments together. But starting off, we have finally found footage of tardigrade mating, and it's even weirder than we expected. So a bunch of shows ago, we did about tardigrades, or the water bears, which are those little those tiny creatures, only a few hundred micrometers long, but almost impossible to kill. They can survive the vacuum of space, endure total desiccation, and can even bounce back from being frozen for decades at a time. We now finally have footage of the strange creatures mating, and researchers have shown it's even more complicated than expected. So I did post this video. So when it does come to mating, researchers already knew that some water bear species were bisexual, something that's not uncommon in the animal world, and it was suspected that fertilization happened outside the body, but everything else is mysterious. So they finally observed it, and the first step of the mating process is the female laying her eggs, and that happens during one of the animal's many molting periods when they shed their outer cuticle skin. So the eggs are laid on the inside of that outer layer of cuticle, and then a male approaches and gets into a position around her, a process that can take several minutes. So once he's in the right spot, the water bears engage, and I just put a really gross explanation because I was reading a bit of this beforehand.
You read a little segment of this to me, I believe.
Yeah, right? So I will skip the details of it because it is horrifying. But fertilization happens outside of the body, underneath that cuticle skin. And the team also found that if no mating occurred, the females reabsorbed their eggs. Oh. So... So there was that first story. And again, I cut out. If you guys want to go search, I'll post the video at least, which is just looks like really nothing.
Tardigrade
like
porn.
Tardigrade porn, yes. It's our first. Maybe I'll have to label this explicit, this show. We're going to get kicked off of Facebook. Under story number two, rejoice, you can now download Netflix shows offline. Mm-hmm. So attention all Netflix users, you can now download shows and movies for viewing offline. To get offline downloads, just update your iOS, Android, or Amazon Fire app. Once you have updated, you can select available for download from the Netflix menu on your mobile device and see the entire collection of downloadable content. It's sorted into the types of categories you're used to based on other content you've watched in the past. If you're browsing Netflix the normal way, you can identify offline friendly content, blah, blah, blah. So the reason this has taken so long is because allowing downloads means securing a whole new set of rights from the people who made the TV shows and movies. That's one reason Netflix has invested so heavily in creating original content. If it owns the right to its own show, it can do whatever it wants. So that's another thing I always phrase it. We keep talking, and that usually means I complain at you about yes. something for a while yes. you just sit there and type away at something else. But about how it seems increasingly that the back catalog of Netflix has just been terrible. I mean, there's nothing when you think of an old movie that you want to watch or this and that, it's just not there anymore. And you brought up the fact that
they've slashed their licensing, they've slashed their licensed products very significantly over the last couple of years.
Right. And
like
that's 50%. Why, and they make a big deal of like, guess what's coming to Netflix this on? Like, they're just telling you that they've been ripping you off this whole time, all the time before this. So who's picking up? I guess that back catalog is now just all rental, like through Amazon, I guess, or YouTube.
Amazon and iTunes and YouTube and Google Play all do those.
Yeah.
And so you can get them by rental.
Because I wonder if there's going to be another thing where you can do a subscription model just to get whatever you want instead of having to rent per movie, or if it's always going to be that like video store thing of renting. Renting movies just seems so...
So antiquated?
Antiquated, but I mean, it's I don't know. It just seems weird to me. So anyway, you can do Netflix offline now, which apparently you've been able to do with Google or with Amazon Video for quite some time.
Yeah, for several months. Amazon unleashed that, I think, like 6 months ago, six months ago.
Yeah. All right, moving on to our last story, which is interesting and a challenge to you, but also has some wording in it, and that is pooping in deep space has NASA stumped. It is the Space Poop Challenge from NASA. So the NASA agency is seeking a system to manage fecal, menstrual, and urine waste for 6 days, up to 144 hours, as NASA wrote on its website. The technology integrated into a spacesuit would be needed for extended tasks in space as well as contingency scenarios. So how NASA solved the problem in the past depended on... how it solves the problem in part depends on you. So they're doing a crowdfunding source thing that to design a system that can collect up to 75 grams of fecal matter and 1 liter of urine per day for 6 days. It must be hands-free, operate in microgravity, and prevent leaking precious oxygen. The reward is up to $30,000, plus the knowledge that the fruits of your mind may someday get us... This article says... gird an astronaut's loins. Calm down, article. So the quote from NASA astronaut Richard Mastracchio says, as humans push beyond low Earth orbit, travel the moon and Mars, we may have many problems to solve, most of them complex technical problems, but some are as simple as how do we go to the bathroom in space. Currently, astronauts who need to evacuate their bowels during rocket launches or spacewalks, which could be up to 8 hours, rely on absorbent diapers.
Of course.
Terrible phrase number one. But diapers are not a viable long-term solution, Mark, when it comes to getting into space. Should it become necessary to keep astronauts alive for days within a spacesuit, that can lead to irritation and infection. So the new system must work with the Modify Advanced Crew Escape Suit, which is the suit NASA plans to use on the future Orion crafts into deep space. So I do, I'll let you decide, Mark, how to proceed in this next tiny section of this same article. I have a little explanation on how we poop in space now and a little section on how we used to do it. Would you like to hear that?
Yes.
Okay. So how we poop to now, so, now in space.
So before you go into the details, there's a couple caveats about relieving oneself in space, a couple stories. One is the Alan Shepard had no preparation. No, they hadn't really considered. He was just going into space and returning, and they hadn't. And so the length of the mission wasn't going to be but a couple hours.
Right.
And so they hadn't considered any facility for that. But he had been in the capsule, in the Mercury capsule, waiting for a long time. And so, like, right before launch, he had to go.
Right.
And everything was sealed. Everything's ready. And he had to wet his spacesuit. And so that's famous Alan Shepard story.
He wasn't even the first man on the moon.
No. But at our office, we've got an HTC Vive, the virtual reality experience.
Headset.
There is a phenomenal experience that we bought, which is the Apollo
VR pooping in space.
VR pooping in space is the Apollo 11 experience, it takes you through the entire Apollo 11 from being on the launch pad and getting a first view sense of the enormity of the Saturn V rocket, through being in the cockpit during launch, and then all of the steps down to being next to Neil Armstrong while he lands on the moon, and you can look out the window and you can see all the little controls, and it's really, really phenomenal.
That's neat.
But as you are in the capsule, you can look around and see the little station the pooping and peeing station. There's just a bunch of tubes and
it is a series of tubes. So how they do it now is the seated space toilet meant for pooping has a fan connected to it that creates suction. Waste ends up in a plastic bag that astronauts push down into a solid waste container, which is changed roughly every 10 days according to astronauts. The urine gets recycled how they used to. So in the 60s, pooping in space has sure come a long way since the 60s, when they used to openly soil themselves. Astronauts used to use adhesives to attach fecal collection bags to their butts. So, like, literally just
taping a diaper
to their butt. Not even a diaper, a bag. Oh. Like one of the produce bags from, they just had the roll of them.
Shame.
We're the first people in space. Poop in a bag.
Here's a cork. that's our solution.
And that took up to an hour. Wow. So you have just a few weeks until December 20 to tell NASA the best way to solve this problem. I do have a little... There was something else about how much fecal matter Scott Kelly produced in his year in space. It was 180 pounds. When they put it out, it turns into shooting stars because it burns up in the atmosphere. So 180 pounds of shooting star worthy. Thank you, Scott Kelly. We wished upon those stars. You made our dreams come true. So that's all I have for story. Do you have any new stories?
Not.
Or are you fresh out?
We will be talking a little bit about a news item that happened over the last week is what prompted the story about Chernobyl.
Oh, I did have not full stories on them, but a couple of Portland mentions, both the great bar/restaurant/places, Jimmy Mac's and the Green Dragon. The Green Dragon is being rebooted or something.
Yeah, they're changing the name. It'll still serve beer, but they're changing the format and the name and everything.
Okay. And Jimmy Mac's, which is over in the Northwest Parks block, which is a legendary jazz place. But as you and I and our friend Rebecca knew, it is the place we all gained like 30 pounds one summer because they had the most amazing food. And we used to, our advertising agency used to be down there, and we would go there for lunch, and they had the most amazing, like, triple decker club sandwich that, best sandwich I've ever eaten was at Jimmy Mac's, but they changed the menu a long time ago. But
yeah, and they had the the basement bar, which was also phenomenal.
Right, that's right.
And we'd just go there after work for happy hour.
That's right. I forgot about the basement part of that. But yeah, the owner is sick. He has cancer and he's fighting that. So he's taking off time to focus on his health. So I'm unsure what is going to be happening to Jimmy Max. But for now, let's go to our friend, the Unipiper, and he'll tell us a couple more things that are happening in and around Portland, and we'll come back. So we'll be right back. Have you seen the video of the guy punching the kangaroo in the face?
To save his dog. Yes.
He squares off against the guy, just right in the face.
Kangaroos right in the are kisser. Mean.
There's
Brian.
There's Brian. All right. Oh. Hello, Brian.
Hey, Todd.
How are you doing? It's Brian the Unipiper calling in. What a surprise.
Hi there.
So we talked a little bit about some restaurants that are going to be closing down, Jimmy Max and the Green Dragon. But what else is happening in and around Portland, Brian?
Okay. Well, this time I was so bummed about my Mai Tai fact last time not being true. I did find something interesting about Portland that is true to share this time.
Okay.
Did you know that Pioneer Courthouse Square back in the 19-teens was called Liberty Square?
Really?
Did not know that.
When did it change?
Well, I think they built Pioneer Square in the 80s, and it was a hotel sometime between then. But Liberty Square was home to something called Liberty Temple. And it looked like a Greek temple that was built all by volunteers.
Oh, wow.
As a place to hold patriotic rallies. And it was the headquarters for the group that was collecting loans to fund the nation's World War I campaign.
Oh, wow. That's crazy.
Yeah. And there's a really neat picture from the Oregon Historical Society of they just put it up. It looks like in the middle of the intersection of the block there. And then eventually after the war, it was forced to move before it was torn down like a year later. But there's just a really neat photo of in the middle of the intersection, there's this mini Greek temple and people rallying around it.
Oh, weird. Huh. I saw another historic picture of Portland that looked like, you know, when you see pictures of Wall Street in New York City, how they look like Greek buildings, but just like kind of etched into the city, like they have pillars and stuff like that. But there's still, I mean, just Mark's giving me a blank look because, you know, it's making me uncomfortable. Like he doesn't know what I'm talking about. But I saw another one. There was like a building in Portland that looked like that with big columns on it. But it was just on one of the side streets that was torn down in like the 30s or something. But I've seen a couple different really cool Portland historical photos that have been going around Facebook, at least this past week.
Yeah, there's actually a lot of interesting history in Portland that you don't hear about. So
nice.
Speaking of Portland history, this past week, there was also a very historic event in Portland. This bit of news comes courtesy of our good friends at the Keep Portland Weird Facebook page.
Nice.
But on Thursday, the very last single space parking meter was removed from the city of Portland.
Oh, interesting.
Wow.
Yeah. That was a process that they started back in 2002.
Wow.
They started to phase those parking meters out and replace them with the multi-use.
I remember having people that would visit Portland over the last, you know, however many years, 15 or so, that would see those, especially back then, see the parking meters that took the card or whatever, and there's just one on each block, and it would blow their minds. And as much as I disliked having to walk further to like put your card in or whatever, it was nice that you could share, you can use that same time amount in any space around Portland as long as you still had time left, which I thought was a really great idea. And they took cards, which was nice. You didn't need quarters anymore. So where was that last one?
There's a photo of it, but it didn't say where it was. But it will, that last meter is going to wind up in the on display at the Oregon Historical Society.
Oh, good. Nice. Good. Nice.
Yeah. I feel like as I travel now, I see those new style credit card meters in more and more locations. So they're definitely spreading and catching on.
Nice. Nice, nice. Well, anything else for us?
So most importantly, I have to let everyone know that a Portland holiday lighting tradition has returned yet again. And I'm not talking about zoo lights or Peacock Lane or the red nose on the white stag sign. Of course, I'm talking about the 30-foot-high Christmas light martini glass in the West Hills.
Oh, yes.
This marks the 40th year since it first went up.
Nice. We had at one of the shows that we've done, we had a little story about it because the guy refurbished it with LED lights and built a new, because for a while it had to be taken down for some reason, but then they rebuilt it. So it's up.
Yeah.
Which is just an iconic thing. There's a hill overlooking Portland that there's a giant outline of a martini glass with an olive on it.
Yeah. Nick, myself, and my mom, we drove up there last year.
Oh, neat.
And got as close as we could to it.
It used to be like urban legend, like, because it wasn't when it was turned on and wasn't turned on, wasn't all that consistent. And so people were like, when it's on, that means the party's happening. And he wants people to come up, and when it's off. And so I don't know if that was ever true of any of it, but oh, yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, that was the urban legend behind it. It was it's actually a really cool story about how it first went up and the reason why. It was first put up in 1976 by a high school student who put it up for fun. it, you know, obviously caught on and people started to recognize it. And it became a familiar symbol in the city of Christmas cheer or an homage to Portland's anti-establishment ethos. But eventually when the house was sold in the 80s, the person who bought it on the condition that the previous owners give him the martini glass so he could continue to have it up.
Oh, that's awesome.
That's fantastic.
And then he kept it up until I think just like 3 or 4 years ago when he sold the house. And that's actually when it went dark for, I think, 3 years. And then last year was the first year that it had come back. With all of its LED lighting upgrades.
Nice. Yeah, it's pretty cool looking. And it's always, you always see that, and you kind of forget that it's going to go up every year, and you kind of get a little excited. Like, yep. The same thing with the light banners on the US Bancorp Tower, how they unfurl those, the lighting from the top down based on how many contributions to charity that they were making or however they do that.
Now, I don't remember seeing this, but apparently after 10 p.m. in years past, the martini glass would have a red no sign over it.
Yes, I've seen that. It's for no drunk driving, because I think Mothers Against Drunk Driving got all upset 1 year. So I think they added that around there for like when you're not allowed to, like after hours or something like that.
Yes, they wanted it removed. So that was the compromise that after 10 p.m. they would put up the no sign. Ultimately, I read an interview with the high school student who first put it up, Monty Meadows, and when they asked him why a martini glass, his answer, it was the 1970s, cocktail parties were cool.
Indeed. That's awesome.
There'd be a can of Red Bull and vodka up there now. 5-hour energy drink.
four loco.
Fantastic. Thanks once again, Brian, for calling in. If people wanted to find out more about the Unipiper, what can they do?
They can point their browsers over to unipiper.com. And stay tuned soon, because this weekend I was out filming a little holiday hijinks myself. So I'll be excited to share that in the coming weeks.
Nice. A little holiday hijinks.
Yeah, make sure they follow your page on Facebook as well. Get all the updates.
Yes. Well, thank you for joining us. We'll talk to you again later, Brian.
Thank you, guys.
All right, bye.
Bye-bye. Yep. That was great fun with Brian.
That
Thanks,
was.
Brian.
I'm glad we had that conversation. Wow. It was both informative and hilarious. So we are going to talk, and I think we talked about Chernobyl a little bit when we did our show about nuclear power.
Yeah.
I'm wondering... It used to, back in like 1997 or 98, I worked with a company that was putting together like kind of a safety and security cleanup type operation video, and it was for Chernobyl, and it was for an overseas market. And so they wanted us to make sure that it was that Chernobyl, which in America we kind of spell C-H-E, like share, C-H-E-R-N-O-B-Y-L, but they wanted C-H-O-R, and that's... And they said that was important because it was Chernobyl or whatever. And so in my head, whenever I see Chernobyl, I get that, well, you know, to do it correctly, you have to. But then I was looking up different pronunciations online, and I found this.
Chernobyl.
And I still don't know.
Chernobyl.
Chernobyl.
And
Chernobyl.
I don't know. This video goes on for a minute.
Chernobyl.
A minute and 38 seconds. Sadly, it doesn't get
Chernobyl
any slower than that, but. So how do you, and I always picturing in my head you pronouncing it funny too, but I don't know if you're just doing that to
I only know it as Chernobyl.
Okay.
Chernobyl. And so that's how I've always pronounced it.
I always picture you in my head going Chernobyl to be
Chernobyl.
Chernobyl.
Yeah. Chernobyl. So I was 15 when the Chernobyl nuclear accident happened. And I remember.
What year was that then?
That was in 1986. It happened in April of 1986.
Okay, so I was 11.
You were 11. And so if you remember when Top Gun came out, that was the same time that we all heard about Chernobyl.
Okay.
And so I recalled that happening. I recall a very syncopated relationship in my mind around those two events, because I think we were talking about both things in German class, in Herr Davies class, in high school. And so I remember both of those kind of being interrelated for me, like they'd happened at the same time. And so I then looked up the dates, and there was pretty much a blackout of news around Chernobyl for a couple weeks. And then we got the information, started leaking, the information started leaking, as well as the radiation into the United States a couple weeks later. And then, so that would have put it the first 2 weeks of May of 86, and Top Gun released on the 16th of May of 86. And so they're all kind of interrelated.
Why do you remember the actual date of Top Gun being released?
I looked it up. I didn't remember that. So I looked up the date of release of Top Gun.
A day that lives in infamy. I think the only thing I remember, because I was just looking at other movies that came out in 1987, and I don't think at that point my family was really seeing a lot of movies in the theater unless they were Star Wars. We were allowed to see those ones. But I think my mom and dad went out of town or something like that, and we were either staying over at somebody else's house or they were staying with us or whatever, but they brought us to see Top Gun. And I remember it must not have been Poltergeist, because Poltergeist had already been out by then, but it could have been a sequel or something like that, the preview played before Top Gun. And I remember being terrified of that. And then watching Top Gun, which I liked, but then had like all the sexy parts of like blowing curtains. And I was like, I don't know what to do with this information. I don't know if mom and dad would approve.
Kelly McGillis getting all
totally
sexy
with anyway, that's funny that's tied in your brain
in my brain they happen at the same time. And so
that was the summer of the Lost Boys and Lethal Weapon came out, if I recall
right, and
RoboCop was opening.
So at that point, at being 15, I had played my Scram video game for the last 5 years on my Atari 800.
And that video game is what, for people who don't know?
So Scram is the term for an emergency shutdown of a reactor. And there's a video game made for the Atari 800 called Scram, and it is a nuclear power simulator, and is watching the diagram of a nuclear power plant. You operate that nuclear power plant, and an incident occurs, and you look at the gauges and flow rates, temperatures of the plant, and determine what failed.
Right.
And so, like, I had this close relationship with nuclear power. And then, in 86, in 89, I joined the Navy and became a nuclear power plant operator. And so while I was on the submarine, 3 years later in 91 and 92, I had access to the government's top secret information about Chernobyl, and it was part of my required reading like what really happened behind the scenes, like what was the sequence of events of the reactor operation to cause the disaster that happened. It wasn't a political document; it was a technical document.
Interesting,
and I won't share those
details.
And I
would like to read all 157 pages now.
Not share any of those details, but there's lots of information that's been declassified since then and what happened.
So confirm and deny some of it, but not all of it.
I can't confirm or deny anything. but it all boils down to the The number four reactor at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. So they had four reactors. This was the newest, greatest one that had been only online a couple years. And in the middle of the night on a Saturday, they were doing a test to check the emergency coolant system. And so in the normal power operation, the reactor makes heat. That heat boils water to make steam. That steam turns turbines to make electricity. That electricity powers the water pumps that power the water to make that whole process happen.
Right. And it's just still, I mean, I say this every time we talk about this, but it's still just to make steam.
It's absolutely just to make steam.
I mean, yeah. That just seems so ridiculous and right. So like elemental or whatever.
Yeah. Well, the details were being sorted out on exactly if the emergency, the backup cooling system would be able to support operation. And apparently that hadn't been fully tested. Seems
ironic.
I
don't know.
So they turned off their safety backup cooling things to test this whole situation. There's two or three very significant design flaws in the type of reactor that is used here. And inherent stability is something that we want in nuclear reactors. And inherent stability means if nuclear power goes up, then that changes the temperature and density of the water that is as part of the nuclear power plant, mm-hmm. and that causes reactor power to go down so that you don't get a feedback loop where reactor power goes up, the temperature goes up, it creates more steam, which in turn causes more reactor power. That is a runaway or inherently unstable condition.
Okay.
And that is how these reactors were built. So they were inherently unstable because of their...
Somebody got the plus minus wrong.
Right. Their design was inherently unstable. So they had two core instabilities. One is a positive void coefficient and one's a positive power coefficient. And they both are related to... the use of water within the reactor. And when things go bad, the system in the United States and Europe, the rest of Europe, the reactors, when things go bad, they inherently get less bad because when temperature increases, the power decreases. In these reactors in Chernobyl, when reactor power goes up, the temperature goes up, causes reactor power to go up, and it runs away. Additionally, we were talking about a scram. A scram is when you've got the reactor core. We have control rods, and control rods absorb neutrons and stop the process of fission, or incredibly slow it down. So when the rods are deep in the core, fission... comes to a halt. And when reactors are, the rods are raised up, that means that reactor power will increase significantly. So they raise the rods too much and too fast, causing a runaway chain reaction process with all of their backup systems turned off. And then they...
Have they done this part on purpose yet to test the thing, or this is happening because they didn't...
They never made it to the test. It said that the explosion of the power plant happened before the test was really initiated.
Okay.
They were doing the steps to initiate the test and cause this all to occur. So in American plants, the control rods, when they go back into, when a scram happens, the rod is released and a spring pushes the rod faster than gravity into the core. So when you have a scram, that means all the rods get released and get pushed into the core by springs to shut down the reactor, the chain reaction process immediately.
Right.
in these Russian reactors.
In Russia, spring reacts you, or I don't know what Yakov Smirnov would say.
Exactly. They happen slower than gravity because they are chain driven, and so they drop into, they're released, but then they are slowed down by a cable basically holding it up.
Right.
And so they happen less, slower than the acceleration of gravity.
Okay.
Instead of faster than the acceleration of gravity. So all of those added up to a disastrous runaway chain reaction where the reactor got too hot too fast and ultimately had a steam bubble that then exploded the whole internals to the external. And a fire ensued because all of the heat in there lit the graphite on fire. And okay. So now you had this blaze that went on for 2 days.
And is this all in a contained structure right
this
now?
This is the contained structure, the roof blew off the top.
Of it. Okay.
And so you had this open gaping hole.
So when you see pictures of Chernobyl, that's what you're looking at.
Exactly.
Okay.
And you have open gaping hole. The fire that was coming out of it, they say, looked like a rainbow volcano. It just was multicolored and just a stream of like nuclear fire going up, right? It was just...
how I want to go out, a stream of nuclear fire.
There were people, there's a fisherman that's still alive that was near there fishing in a river at 2 a.m. and
quote unquote
was watching
him and Jack Daniels.
Seriously, more likely vodka,
right.
But he witnessed it firsthand.
Wow.
and saw this and lived to tell the tale.
That's crazy.
So the fire is out there. There's a couple people that die almost immediately. And the scope and magnitude of the damage.
So this is situated in Ukraine.
In Ukraine.
Here's what I know about Ukraine. Chernobyl's there. Chernobyl is there.
Kiev.
Okay. Now Kiev, I know Kiev is there.
Kiev is there.
I always want to put, I always hear Kiev and I want to put it somewhere else. Like, I never want to put it in Ukraine, but yeah, okay.
Yeah, Kiev is there. And it's less than 100 miles from Belarus. Okay. So Minsk, Belarus.
Not a huge country.
Yeah. And so all of this is all part of the CCP at the CCCP, the Soviet Union at
okay.
the time.
Okay.
And
so then Eastern Russia.
Yeah. Very Eastern Russia. Very just past the Eastern or very Western Russia. Very Eastern edge of Europe, basically,
right.
Just past the east edge of Europe.
Yeah, West Russia, I guess.
And the sequence of events that happen over the next couple weeks are difficult to nail down. How much is just misunderstanding of, like, we had never in our universe had this type and this scope of a nuclear disaster. And so the reaction to it and how to deal with it just wasn't established. And
right.
So Russia didn't know exactly what to do, but they also were fantastic about keeping all of the information from getting out. And so they were...
Well, the Soviet Union, known for their forthcomingness.
Known for their forthcomingness. And so I watched an interview with Gorbachev, and he found out more information about the extent of the casualty from Sweden than he did from his own people, because
wow.
they were measuring release of contaminants and the ensuing cloud of radioactive material in Sweden before Gorbachev really had the breadth of how much of a disaster
right.
this really was, because
right.
the people on the ground and, you know, the people that were the firefighters and first responders weren't even aware that it was the nuclear part that was was exploded. They just thought there was a fire at the building, and they had no idea that the scope of what they were getting themselves into. When that started to come out, the release into the atmosphere, how much was being released into the atmosphere and blown around with winds, just wasn't being measured, and it right. wasn't a big, you know, it was a lack of knowledge.
Right. They were too busy using their aerosol hairspray and their CFC.
Exactly. And there's a little town there called Pripyat that is about 3 kilometers, so about a mile and a half from the Chernobyl power plant. That town was built in many ways to support the power plant.
Yeah, it's like an industry town.
Yeah, and so it had 50,000 people. It really was started in the 1920s and became kind of the breadbasket for Russia. And so there was lots of farming, lots of cattle, and lots of fields of grain and right. and those kind of things. They were not told of how much of a problem was there, the citizens of Pripyat, for almost 2 days. And then when it finally did come down that they were receiving hundreds of
kilojoules
full of death, they were receiving so much radiation that they were going to be killed. And there's 50,000 people there. They were told, and because the people talking to Gorbachev said, yeah, this isn't that big of a deal. We'll have the power plant back online in May. You know, this not a big problem. There's a
nothing
little fire
to see here. It's like Leslie Nielsen in The Naked Gun standing in front of the burning fireworks factory. Nothing to see here. Please disperse.
And so they told the people, okay, you have 2 hours. We're sending buses into the town. We're going to evacuate this town.
This is 2 hours after explosion?
No, 2 days after the explosion.
Okay.
You have 2 hours to gather your stuff for a temporary evacuation. So bring your money, bring any documents, bring any like necessities that you have, and you probably want some
anything
food
that'll ID your body, just whatever can fit in your bag.
And
dental records.
And so they had more than 1,200 buses show up to the town.
Wow.
That stretched for more than 7 miles long.
Jeez.
And they evacuated the entire town. And in less than a day, it went from 50,000 people to just a military contingency on site. And
you
became
can
a ghost
find
town.
Some beautiful and scary photography of that abandoned town. Because like you said, the schools are still like had the stuff on the desk. Homes had stuff.
Absolutely.
I mean, everyone abandoned it in 2 hours. Wow.
And so people were told this is a temporary. And right. I watched a video clip of the news announcement to the town. You know, there's been a problem at the power plant. Everything's going to be fine. We're doing a temporary evacuation. The bus will be there in 2 hours. Grab documents. Grab your money. Grab some food. This is just a temporary thing. We'll be right back. Right.
Man.
And they have never been allowed back ever. And so all of your life was limited
behind.
To whatever you happened to gather in that 2 hours. There were plenty of old people who wouldn't believe that there was actually a problem because they didn't trust the government.
Right.
And they're like, I'm here. There's nothing going on. What are you talking about?
Right.
And their bodies were found a couple weeks later. Yeah. Just like,
ironically, they were right about the government not telling them the truth. They just took the wrong turn at that intersection.
Right, right. And
it's like that Harry Truman guy who lived on Mount St. Helens who refused to evacuate and was buried under 9,000 feet of mud.
Exactly. So
cranky old people are heroes to us all.
Yeah, and so to try and contain the reactor so that there's fire coming out, the initial first response was to douse it with water. It seems like a good plan. The problem was that water went into a void, into a room below the reactor. And then they were dumping concrete on top of that. over the next few days, they just started dumping concrete and sand into there.
Okay.
Now you had sand covering molten uranium, ultimately, just this molten slag of metal that wasn't cooling down, with a pool of water underneath it, which was, if you think about what that design looks like, that is the preparations for a big explosion. And if that molten core went into that void down below and then touched that water, that would then flash to steam, and the pressure of the sand and concrete would just cause it to make a bigger and more disastrous explosion. And there's estimates of that would have annihilated a 40-mile radius and made much of Europe uninhabitable.
Oh my God.
And so there were heroes of Russia who went into that water void and drained the water by opening valves. And they almost immediately died afterwards, but they...
From radiation.
From radiation exposure.
So now, what happens when you die of radiation? I mean, that sounds daft, but I mean, yeah. All I know is like from the end of RoboCop, also, which came out in 1987, where the guy steps in toxic waste.
In 86.
Stepped in... you know, toxic waste or whatever, and he becomes a monster and like skin bubble. But like, what in reality happens?
So there's a couple phases. when I watch four documentaries coming into this about like
all uppers, I'm sure,
all great about Chernobyl. One of them went into extensive coverage of the medical aftermath. It happens. There's kind of three phases. The first phase is almost immediately nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, and you know, your body is just responding, and that subsides, and then there's this interstitial period where there's not many symptoms at all, and then the flesh starts burning away. Basically,
oh my gosh,
the your liver, your heart, your flesh, just burn and expose they've been burnt and now they are revealing the burn, if
okay,
you will.
Yeah,
and so
yeah.
Flesh is falling off and it's just massive. It's like, you know, leave something in the microwave too long. It's not the same
a physiological level. Like, do you know what's happening? Like happens to your, like, what does that mean?
So that ionizing radiation is just destroying cells. And so it is just going through your body and kicking the ass of so many cells in your body. And then those cells are responding and dying, or you know, trying to replicate and breaking.
So is that radiation a wavelength? Is it a thing like a poison in the air? What is radiation?
Yeah, there's several different types, and I should have prepared some more detail about this. But there's gamma radiation that kind of shoots through you.
That's how you make a Hulk.
Exactly. There's also alpha radiation and beta radiation, and each have different types of exposure to you. Like alpha radiation can be stopped literally by a piece of paper, but if you'll find alpha radiation in dust.
Okay.
And so if you ingest that, it tears apart your lungs.
Jeez.
Beta has its own delivery method, and then gamma basically can go through anything and is only stopped by lead. And so there's different types of radiation that are penetrating your body and causing it to be annihilated.
Is it a part of a different spectrum than just that big, you know, you always see the electromagnetic spectrum or whatever with the microwave radiation and all that.
Yeah, a lot of this.
For those of you watching on Facebook, you can see my hand going up and down to show that thing that I'm talking about.
Yeah.
Or is it like a catch-all term, because that's kind of the only way to understand it?
It's more of a catch-all term, okay. But basically any type of radiation is either a photon that is going to interact with a cell, or it's a neutron that's going to interact with a cell. It's, you know, it's radiating energy is going to happen in the, in either the radio frequency spectrum and RF radiation, or physical, you know, particle radiation, where you've got neutrons being bombarded into your system.
Okay.
And all of them cause different types of damage and pretty extensive damage.
Jeez. So it just kind of fries you from the inside.
Yeah. And
that is horrifying.
It's absolutely horrifying. And
read about tardigrade sex again, kind of bring the room back up. Or
so what if you were to look at some of the positive things that happened because of Chernobyl.
Oh, I thought you said when you become irradiated.
When you become irradiated.
You could momentarily fly.
Is, you know, this was 1986, and we had incredible tension between ourselves and Russia. And Gorbachev had only been the leader, is it prime minister in
Britain?
Russia
and
Soviet Union,
the Tsar.
That yeah, a few.
I
years
think it's
after
probably. It feels like one of those places that they would call it the president, just yeah. Like they call it like the people's whatever.
Yeah. So
dear leader, perhaps.
Right. So Premier? Gorbachev was the leader of the Soviet Union, and he had only been the leader for a year at that point, and so he needed some wins.
They actually, I just looked it up on, I looked at Mikhail Gorbachev. Mikhail Gorbachev is a former Soviet statesman. He was the eighth and final leader of the Soviet Union. They just called them
the leader.
Yeah, the leader. All right, then. Fair well, enough.
I mean,
that
something.
Was simple.
No, nope. No, there was a term. There was a term for it, I'm sure, right?
The president, well, the president of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
That's funny. Anyway. That was your quick bit of Russian history. Right. That probably isn't correct.
And so, so this helped to give a demonstration to people of the effect of radiation that would happen in the case of a nuclear war.
Oh, okay.
And so it helped to contextualize, oh crap, if this. So Chernobyl was, and I'll probably get some of these numbers wrong. Chernobyl was the equivalent of 400 Hiroshimas.
Okay.
The cloud of Hiroshima being released to the atmosphere is about 400 of those. The number one missile at the time, that the top nuclear missile at the time, was like 125 times more powerful than Chernobyl, and they had 2,700 of them.
Jeez.
And so the
let's hear it for the Cold War.
The Cold War, like if there were a nuclear war, the Earth would have just been annihilated.
Right.
And
well, and this, several times with the potential to do it several times over with the amount of weapons that we have.
Right. And this helped to contextualize or put a face on it of, oh, this isn't just you know, nuclear right. power is going to be bad. Yeah, nuclear war is going to be bad. They were now seeing the evidence of nuclear radiation sickness and what that physically looks like on people, and the direct effects and long lasting effects. Pripyat is not going to be habitable for another 20,000 years.
Good grief.
You know, and the half-life of cesium and it's in tens of thousands of years. We're not going, and the amount of contaminated material is more than 20 centimeters deep. So, you know, so almost a foot deep. And so you would have to scrape off the top foot of all of the material in a 30-mile radius, 30-kilometer radius. So yeah. Smaller than that, but a big area. Scrape off all of the material for the top foot of all the soil and everything that is on it, and then dispose of that somewhere else. It's just
it's impossible.
Impossible.
Right.
And so that zone will be like that and uninhabitable for many, many hundreds of so generations.
It does say on the Chernobyl Wikipedia page that the population is 704 people. So it must be
there the guards are, so there's guards. There's this this clan of these old ladies that they're like, well, I'm going to die already. And like, why should I die in a land that I'm not right. familiar with? I'm going to die where I was born and raised, right. And just do it faster, you know. And
good for them.
Yeah. So they're like, little Russian ladies are the best, and you don't want meet one in an alley in a dark
she'll
alley.
Hit you with her purse,
just knock you out,
and her scarves.
Yeah. And so,
so when I've seen pictures and stuff, and one of the things that they'll show is what's called the elephant's foot.
The elephant's foot,
and
yep.
So what is essentially like this room-sized, exactly. hardened slab of whatever that oozed down and is solidified.
Exactly. So underneath the reactor core, into that room that was the void,
right?
Basically molten magma of the reactor core just penetrated the floor and then cooled down,
like
down
lava.
There. And so it looks like a lava flow, and it's called the elephant foot. And
it's like the most radiated thing on Earth or something like that.
Any living creature, if you can physically see it, you're dead.
And I'm remembering now that I saw pictures of people like posing by it, like they're like, hello, or something like that.
There's one picture of it, and it was taken with a mirror around a corner.
Oh, okay.
And so,
I'm inserting all of that in my head.
Yeah, there hasn't been anybody who has physically seen it, but the magnitude of radiation that is being experienced in that area annihilates you in under a minute. You are just dead. So the recovery efforts, now they had the fire, they covered it up, they drained the water underneath. They needed to contain the building. That process was so ridiculous. It took more than 500,000 people.
Jeez.
The range of numbers I've seen, everybody has at least 500,000. The number goes up to 700,000.
Man.
So
is that like counting the janitor?
So what they would do is these shifts of 1 minute periods of time where this group of 50 men would go up to the roof, shovel stuff off of the roof, and then go back down.
Oh, wow.
And you did that for 1 minute, and it was hot and radioactive and intense. And
were these volunteers? Or is this like, we've got our prisoner colony here?
No, everybody was called, like they were doing this as a country.
Wow.
And the cost of this period over the next few months is in the range of like $40 billion.
Wow.
of money spent to try and contain this. So they had to get rid of a lot of the graphite that had there was a lot of graphite in the core that was used to separate the fuel rods. And that graphite was so incredibly radioactive, and most of it had just blown up and out onto the roof area. And so they needed to contain that and get it down into the pit. So they would go up there with their shovels, shovel it off, and then pour concrete over. And so they did that for 2 months with 500 to 700,000 people, 1 minute at a time.
Wow.
And so they would do these shifts where the next person coming in would, you know, just be right behind you, and they would come in and shovel as well. And then
that seems like very Simpsons-esque.
Totally. And then they got it contained within that period and created a sarcophagus around it, basically.
Right.
So in the late, so that happened and was a very significant win for the entire process, and getting that area contained so it's not releasing more fissionable materials, but the damage had been done at that point.
Okay.
But now it's just this slag of molten stuff down below that's still hot and glowing, and now you've got this encapsulated slag of concrete covering the whole thing, a bunch of lead in there as well. When they first started putting lead in, the lead was also flashing to be atomized, basically, and that lead was evaporated into the air, and so there was incredible lead poisoning issues in the area as they were trying to use lead to stop the amount of radiation that was being released. And
so you win some, you lose some,
right?
I guess.
It just not a winning situation anywhere. So in the late 90s, a commission was put together to create the kind of the next layer of containment. And literally last week, it went into place.
I saw that.
And so there's some great videos. It's called the New Safe Containment, or the New Shelter. And it's a structure intended to contain the remains of the nuclear reactor at Chernobyl. And over the next number of years, it's a confinement zone, basically. It's a big airtight dome.
It looks like a gigantic airplane hangar made out of steel. Right. So it had an opening, like if you'd build a Lincoln Log house or whatever, and it had the sidewalls and then the roof.
So,
and then they put that on big tracks, right?
Yeah, it was on tracks on skids that rolled in. You could put the Statue of Liberty inside, and there'd be room above. You could put the Titanic wide in there, and so the it's wider than the Titanic was long.
It was long, jeez.
And so it's the largest moving building ever created in human history, and it's made out of steel and lead, and it's a containment unit that goes over the entire thing. Now they're sealing it, and so over the next year they'll finish the process of sealing it around reactor number 4, and then they are going to start to dismantle some of the previous sarcophagus that was there to try and get to ultimately the core to start to extract that and get that material, you know, the elephant foot out of there. So they've got automated systems and stuff.
Like robots to do that for us.
Right. So
finally, I welcome our new robot overlords to do our dirty work.
So the dome is built to last 100 years, and the sarcophagus that was there currently was only able to support about 30 years. And so it's breaking down and having issues, and so they need to build the next level of containment over that.
Next 100 years. Seems like it should last longer. I mean, we've got bridges that are older than 100 years, buildings that are hundreds of years old.
But
is it just too big to support itself that long?
Too big, and the environment that it's in, like it is receiving the most amount of ionizing radiation in a focal point ever. So, So that's where it's at. So,
so how many people have died because of Chernobyl? Were there any? Because there's going to be the difference between initial explosion that people died in, and then any long term.
The Soviet Union has 56 reported people that have died, like official, as related to Chernobyl.
Let's start here. So
Of the 500,000,
I was going to say, out of the people that were evacuated,
At least. So the documentary that I saw about that is 10 years old.
Okay.
So 10 years ago, at least 20,000 of them had died, and at least 80,000 of them were handicapped in some way. So because of the incident.
Okay.
So 10 years ago, 20% of them were
They elderly, or were they
no
hanging on it? 45.
No,
like 10 years ago were the people
10 years ago
the...
they were in their 40s, okay, and were experiencing convalescent like 60s, 70s, 80s kind of
right
issues.
Okay, wow.
Yeah.
So they were maybe in their 20s.
In their 20s. Okay. Yeah. 20s and 30s. Man. Yeah. So and we know that that just scratches the surface of what really happened.
Right.
You know, there's at least 300 pilots of different helicopters that are dead.
That's the other thing that I've heard too, is the helicopter pilots.
Helicopter
pilots.
Because
they were
doing
what? Trying to like pour stuff on the...
So they would bring up people that would have the bags of sand and bags of concrete and then ultimately bags of lead, lead pellets that they would throw. So they would go up... In the helicopter, it would be like 150 degrees up there because you are literally over
the inferno
of this. Well, during the initial firefighting
right.
part, and it was just there's so many intense stories. Well, one of the plans was to install a cooling system in that void underneath the core, and that cooling system never got installed. But they took a fleet of men to build a tunnel that tunneled in underneath the reactor and opened up this other void below that void. They did basically a 6-month project in 6 weeks, and so many of those men died, both from radiation exposure and from that mining process. They lacked oxygen in a lot of the places, and they were just working too hard and just succumbed to exposure. And it was,
man,
just from tip to tail, it was
just awful.
There's awful.
Nothing
awful.
Good about the Chernobyl nothing, disaster.
Right.
It was aptly named.
Right.
Chernobyl disaster.
Disaster. So
can you feel yourself be irradiated? I wonder. It seems like it would be like listening to really, really loud music, how it like shakes your insides.
Yeah. The experience that they were having, they talked about, which might have been related to the fission, the material that was in the air as well. Their eyes would start hurting and their teeth would start hurting. And so when they closed their mouth and they couldn't feel their teeth hit each other, they knew that they were over their limit and they had to get out or they would die. There was also a metallic taste in their mouth. And so these three symptoms were happening when they were being irradiated on site. Yeah.
That is weird.
It's really
and it's
crazy.
It's just so weird that you can't see it or smell it or.
Yeah. It's
just like
invisible,
wrecking your body.
Invisible enemy that is just.
The silent killer, as it's called.
Right. There are a lot of documentaries on the Chernobyl disaster, but like I watched one on wolves that was it wasn't very good. The documentary wasn't very good.
There are answers,
but there's the interesting to note that there's been no evidence of mutated wildlife in the area, and so there's a lot of free range horses, and the wolf population is up to almost 500 wolves in the area.
There must have
now.
Been an initial dieout, though, right? It's not like it didn't
correct.
Affect
you. Okay. Yeah, exactly.
That would be crazy.
No,
if they just became bigger and stronger somehow.
Yeah, so they're not seeing generations, get, yeah, I've got 6 hooves now and or whatever. They die because of natural causes, and
right. Interesting. Yeah, and there's just some beautiful pictures of people that have gone kind of and explored the area and taken pictures of the classrooms and the buildings and all of that stuff. That's just really neat.
There's a little amusement park there in Pripyat, and so it's very, it's ghostly because
not so amusing now, is it?
Yeah.
Nice. Well, yeah, that's fascinating. And I saw the picture of them moving that big, huge building into place and then sealing it up, which is just crazy to see in scale because you see like other things around it as opposed to, it's just a huge building.
Huge building. Yeah.
So interesting. Well, cool. That was great. Chernobyl, or however they say it.
Chernobyl.
That's the end, I guess. That is the end of this program.
I don't think you've. I was trying to prompt.
Myself.
I was trying to prompt you to say to give the welcome to the Mark and Todd cast, but
I didn't get to that in the beginning.
No.
Yeah, but I did because I talked about it. I didn't know what show number it was, but did I never say why? I just
I was trying to. It's like,
hello and welcome to the Mark and Todd cast.
There you go.
I'm Todd Workoven, and with me, as always, is Mark Middleton. How are you, Mark?
I'm great.
We should get together. We should talk sometime. Oh. We never hang out. So, yes, you can look us up at themarkandtoddcast.com or facebook.com/markandtoddcast. We can see, yeah.
Oh,
do we have some questions?
We do have some notes. So, on my initial, when I had this up, no comments were coming in. And so now there's a slew of comments after I refreshed the page.
Okay.
So, Facebook isn't always giving the notes directly. So,
here, let's go through them. I can edit it down later.
Yeah. So, Kathleen, I asked if audio is good. Kathleen gave us a thumbs up. Sound is good. Jennifer Fish says hi.
This is the Kent says hi. Room section of the room.
Yeah,
again.
Totally. Nick was 4 years old when it happened. And then Kathleen.
Is that age shaving Nick or is that in reality Nick?
I think so. Let's see.
I was one at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. This is age shaving Nick. Yeah. I won't say it officially on the air.
Official age.
And Kathleen, it was on her birthday. Kathleen Burney on 4/26 because it was on my birthday.
Nice.
And here's a good time lapse of the arch going into place.
Ooh,
yeah we'll send
that.
We'll put a link to that, Kathleen. It's
cool.
Awesome. No questions.
No questions. So, we only had answers this week.
Yay.
We must have answered all the questions.
We answered all the questions.
Nobody had anything to ask.
Chernobyl.
So thank you. Yes, thank you for joining us again. We also, this past week, released episode 2 of Portland at the Movies, where we watched Yay. The Hunted and had quite a bit to say about that. So do check that out. You can either get to it on the Market Podcast page itself, where it's posted in our episodes, or you can go to facebook.com/PortlandAtTheMovies. So we will see you guys next time. I'm going to take everyone out here with the 1984 Romper Room Magic Mirror Clip.
Yay.
Just to say goodbye to you. All right. We'll see you guys next time.
Ciao.
You have a good day today, friends.
Yay.
I did.
I had a Superman day.
Everybody's in terrific early 80s bowl cuts, by the way. And they have this giant, a guy in this giant crazy bee costume sitting amongst all these kids. And that bee costume is terrifying.
Magic mirror.
Stomper Boo, tell me do.
Wow.
Magic Mirror, tell me today. Did all my friends have fun at play? All my friends had fun today. I see David's having a special day today.
Maybe
and Olivia
Mark.
Joy had a special day on
it never
Sunday.
Did.
I see Robin had a special day yesterday, and Dana's having a special day today. And so is Reginald and Edward John.
See, I always had a feeling
Margaret.
You had to write in to have
and
her
I
say
see,
your name, like a birthday
I see
thing.
Justin and Megan and Courtney and Brick and Mark.
She looks
and
dead
Rachel
on the
and Sheila
She did say Mark.
Oh, did I talk over?
I think so.
Back up. Okay.
Justin and Megan and Courtney and Brick and Mark and Rachel and Sheila and Caroline all having
finally.
And Cicely and Ashley and Matthew and Jose. And I see Bonnie Jose. And Anthony and Joe had special days yesterday. And so did Tammy and Brandon and Gregory. And of course, friends, you know I see you. And I'll see you again.
That's funny. No ties. All right. See you next time.
Bye.